Hi, welcome to the Wellness Doctors Podcast with Dr. Lorena
and Dr. Vanessa.
We are both medical doctors who talk about how to optimize health and well-being so that you can be empowered to make better healthy choices, enrich the lives of people around you, and join us in the evolution of healthcare.
Hi, everybody. This is Lorena.
And Vanessa.
And also we have a special guest today, Dr. Dickon Weatherby, who is a naturopathic physician. And he's the CEO and founder of Optimal DX, which is a software that actually helps to analyze functional blood markers. And I'm extremely excited to have him on our podcast today. So welcome, Dr. Dickon Weatherby.
Well, it's a total pleasure to be with you today.
So I actually came across Dr. Weatherby's material when very many years ago from his book, which is the blood chemistry and CBC analysis. And I was really excited because another naturopathic doctor had introduced it to me. Happened to be my father. So,
Oh, wow. Fantastic. That's yes. Great.
So he came across it during his training, and because he actually did his naturopathic training after his medical training.
Okay.
So I was really grateful to him for introducing it to me, because I often found that when we do blood testing, there's not really a lot to be found, but patients still had symptoms. So at that stage, I went through your book, and I was really insightful. And I looked at blood markers and blood testing in a really different way.
So
I actually wanted to start off with asking you, for example, like, how did you come across, like, what kind of inspired you to look into this and to develop this software?
Well, just to give you a bit of background, I was born and raised in England, and my mother was very much involved in homeopathy and alternative medicine right from the get-go. So I was raised vegetarian, no antibiotics, no vaccinations or anything like that. So natural medicine was, you know, a big part of our household and how we dealt with coughs and flus and all that sort of thing. So when I, you know, decided I wanted to kind of pursue a career in medicine, it was a no-brainer to think about naturopathic medicine. So I'd already emigrated to the States, and I went to National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon. It's now National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, one of the foremost naturopathic medical schools in the world, I think. And you know, it was in my second year, and a little bit like you, I was studying lab science at the time, and we were having all of these classes on naturopathic philosophy and looking at naturopathic therapeutics. And it was all about how do we help and prevent our patients from getting sick. And yet in our lab sciences, it was all about these are biomarkers that we can help identify pathology. So there seemed to be like a big disconnect to me. And I was in my second year, it was in 1995. I went to a training that Biotics Research Northwest was putting on by a guy called Harry Eidner. He's a PhD researcher on functional blood chemistry. And so it was my first opportunity to really have my eyes opened at the possibility of kind of looking beneath the normal ranges and really diving into this concept of an optimal range and really looking at what does it mean to be optimal as opposed to normal. I started applying that very much into my clinical studies. I graduated in 98, moved to Ashland, Oregon, in Southern Oregon, and worked for a chiropractor, naturopathic physician. And he taught me a ton of information on, you know, in the clinic setting with real patients at that time. So I really kind of got to hone my skills on how to look at blood work from this slightly different perspective. We're looking at exactly the same numbers that allopathic physicians. We're looking at exactly the same test. What we're doing is we're looking at the results in using a slightly different concept. And this concept is that if we tighten up those reference ranges, we have an opportunity to identify at the bottom end and the top end those people that are not necessarily pathological or having tissue change or moving into disease per se, but moving more in that direction. So it became a really important part of my assessment methodologies, so much so that I decided to write a book with my colleague, Scott Ferguson. He and I dove in and wrote this book from more of a naturopathic perspective, trying to put some naturopathic meat on the bones, so to speak. And then I started teaching seminars to my colleagues who heard about it. And then, you know, just grew from that. And people were asking me over and over again, you know, can you please come up with some software? It just takes too long to be able to do all this by hand. And I don't want to have to do spreadsheets and that. So in 2011, I hooked up with a programmer from New Zealand, actually. He's a Canadian that was living in New Zealand. And he and I wrote the program together, and he's still with me. He's my chief technical officer and still very much involved. And yeah, so that's kind of how we, you know, kind of how I fell in love with this methodology, because really for me, it's like, we all know patients arrive in our clinics and they don't feel very well. They may or may not have symptoms of disease, but they definitely have symptoms of dysfunction. Their bodies are not functioning well. And so we have to have methodologies to be able to kind of uncover what's behind all that. Mm. And for me, my career has really been about in four distinct areas of assessment. The first part is, how do you and I, how do clinicians have better conversations with our patients? So really refining and looking at signs and symptoms analysis, because there are clues to the story that our patient has about their history that are really insightful and really helpful to look at the body through this functional lens. The second part is, the human body itself is a wonderful mirror of and a communicator to us as well. We just have to be astute enough to listen to it. You know, in Hong Kong and in China, obviously they have traditional Chinese medicine where you're looking at pulse diagnosis and tongue diagnosis. And, you know, they're very acutely aware that the human body has these maps that communicate information to us. So I wanted to dive into kind of more of a functional and nutritional physical exam. How do we get our hands on our patients and uncover hidden gems of information? And the third area is, there are obviously other fluids other than blood, the saliva and urine and things like that. And so how do we assess in a clinic setting? How do we do further and more differential urinalysis looking at it from this functional lens? And then finally, the blood. The blood obviously doesn't lie. It's a tremendous opportunity to get a really good look at what's going on. And to be honest with you, most people are familiar with what a blood test is. So it seems a natural diagnostic test for us to look through this functional lens. So signs and symptoms, functional physical, functional urinalysis, and then functional blood. So that's been my kind of area of focus.
I guess that's the most comprehensive way you can look at someone, right? From the beginning of how it all started in the history all the way up to what's the latest snapshot that science has brought to us now.
Yes. And I think one of the other wonderful things about blood is, and through this functional approach, we'll talk a little bit more about what that really means, but we have an opportunity with a patient that's sitting in front of us with the blood test results in front of us. That blood has been coursing through their body. Those red blood cells have been coursing through their body for about 3 months. So we actually have a snapshot of the past. We have a snapshot of the present. And then when we look at it through this functional lens, we have an opportunity to look into the future. What is it that you want out of your life in the future? We're standing at this junction between more pain and suffering and misery on the right, or a journey to optimal health on the left. And I think it's really an opportunity to have a really important conversation with our patients about, what is it that you want to achieve and how can we help you achieve that? Because it's our destiny to live a full, pain-free, optimal life where we can enjoy our grandchildren or our children and enjoy our parents as they get older, without all of these diseases and chronic conditions that a lot of which really are maybe preventable in our patients.
You mentioned chronic diseases, and I guess for Lorena and I, we went through the more allopathic conventional medical training. And I remember the times when I was an intern or a houseman and having to read tons of lab results every day for bedside patients.
Yeah.
And as a very busy intern who's very sleep deprived,
yes,
trying very hard to ignore numbers that are not too bad. So that's right. Kind of how the training went, which is, okay, it's not that bad. It's slightly off, you know, or it's red. It's in the red, but it's not, you know,
so three or four times.
Yeah. So maybe we don't have to do anything about it now because someone else is even more sick.
Yeah, that's what one of my early mentors, Greg Graham, talked about as the nightmare of yet.
Mm.
You know, you don't have diabetes yet, so we're going to wait until you do, because we know how to treat diabetes. We don't know how to treat pre-diabetes. And I think that's really the sad thing about the allopathic model, is that, first of all, the training is boot camp, right? Your sleep, I mean, it's the most idiotic training on the planet, really, to put you in 30 hours of rotations. I mean, why? I mean, we don't need to go there. It just makes me mad. And I'm sorry you had to go through that. But if you think about it, if the only tool you have available to you is the scalpel or a bottle of pharmaceutical pills, and that's really what you're trained to do, you're going to look at everything through that lens. Mm. You don't have a training. I'm saying you. It's not you. It's allopathic medicine in general. They don't have a training or an understanding that if you just change your diet, a lot of this stuff can go away. If you look at lifestyle issues, I mean, we're really good at like, oh yeah, don't smoke too much, don't drink too much coffee, don't drink too much alcohol. But the amount of sugar people are putting in their bodies is off the charts. And so, you know, and in America here, if you look at the American Heart Association or the American Diabetic Association, and you look at their recommended diets, it's no wonder we're so sick. Mm. I mean, I know we're kind of straying off topic here, but I mean, you have to look at the interrelationship between the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry.
Because a lot of it, and then you understand as well, and a lot of people actually don't know how to read labels. So I found that in my patients, when I talk to them about, oh, you know, sugar, they think, oh, white sugar on the table that they add, but actually they don't realize it's in the packaging and the processing, and they don't actually read the labels. They really miss it. And they don't see that connection. So. It's definitely something which is quite sad in a way, because I, you know, the way that we're taught is hospital medicine, but we're not really sure what to do. And often I remember writing discharge summaries for patients, so that when they go back to their GPs, they can have continuity of care. But what always I wonder is, well, are they actually being supported from a functional perspective? Because how can we prevent them from coming back in hospital? So that's sort of one of the wake-up calls that I had when I was an intern, realizing that actually a lot of the skills that I had learned was really just for very acute symptom treatments, almost like a military approach. So I think one of the questions that I have, and when I talk about your software and the way that we look at optimal ranges in blood work, some of the questions that my colleagues have are these ranges derived from a specific kind of research, or are there sort of studies of populations where they looked at these numbers and markers and then correlated them to different sort of disease risks? I know that recently you had a new marker, which is the thyroid ratios, and that's relevant to different kind of conditions and diseases, and the trend also in the actual blood work gives a clue as to the mortality and morbidity of these illnesses. Because I often get asked that same question, because when we actually show ranges from the report, but also in previous labs that they've done, they sometimes will notice that the range is actually quite different. And so one of the things that I learned from your book earlier on is that depending on what population you're actually measuring, that bell curve shifts. So the shifting of that curve then just reflects the population's status. It doesn't actually tell us individually where that person is. So,
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are no standard ranges. I mean, really, there is nothing. I mean, I know we can get our lab textbooks and things like that, and we can look and see, and they give you a stab at, you know, this is what a healthy BUN is or a healthy creatinine and that sort of thing.
I guess even in the literature, there are healthy populations that are studied and published. So, for example, a lot of the studies on athletes or younger, healthier population of people, where you have reference ranges for what optimal looks like.
Yeah.
So that's published evidence that we can all reference as well.
Athletes are high-performance athletes are another strange variability too.
Yeah.
Because
we can work.
Well, yeah, because but then again, what's your definition of health? Because my son's high performance hockey ice hockey player, and I've been testing his. He's 22 and he plays college hockey here in the US. And you know, I've been testing his blood since he was about 15. And when I look at his blood work through my software, he doesn't come out very well.
Oh dear.
His liver enzymes are high. You know, it's like there are certain biomarkers that cross the board. And that's what I love about historical values too, by the way. I can see historically that, you know, these are consistent biomarkers that high performance athletes don't operate the same way that we do. And what might be considered to be pathological or dysfunctional is actually quite, I mean, I hate to use the word normal, but it is actually quite normal for them. So I can't remember off the top of my head which biomarkers shift, but, you know, liver enzymes is definitely one of them.
And that's, I often see that too. And, AST is often high in people who do a lot of training. And they often come in and they say, oh, my doctor says something's wrong with my liver.
Well, you know, have to remember that AST, a large amount of the AST is actually the skeletal muscle. So you know that. So if you think about high performance athletes that are working out in the gym every day, they're that's why their creatine kinase is so high, and that's why their creatinine is so high. So we're not looking at kidney issues here. We're just looking at their, you know, breaking down and replacing. They're more in an anabolic state with, in terms of muscle building and that sort of thing.
So what other trends and patterns would you say is quite common? So, for example, we see a lot of people with fatigue. And is there anything that we could look out for in terms of a standard panel?
You know, that was kind of a curious question, because I would say that if we looked at the top symptom that every patient is suffering from is fatigue. So from a functional perspective, obviously, we're thinking about, when is that fatigue occurring? Are we looking at blood sugar dysregulation in terms of tired and fatigued, maybe first thing in the morning or maybe after lunch and that sort of thing? Or are we looking at adrenal issues or sex hormone issues and things like that? In those situations, I tend not to get too focused on the condition or the symptom that someone's complaining of. I try and take a much more of a systems approach. That's why, you know, if you look at the breakdown of how we look at biomarkers and how we look at patterns, the very first thing we do is we look at a sort of a very broad systems approach, looking at the 13 different interconnected body systems. And try to see, you know, where is dysfunction located within those systems? And then we can drill in a little bit deeper. So I would say from a fatigue perspective, the two probably main areas would be adrenal health and then blood sugar dysregulation. So what type of biomarkers will we be looking at? Fasting glucose, hemoglobin A1C, fasting insulin, C-peptide. You'd get an estimated average glucose. We're about to add in the HOMA-2 calculator for insulin resistance can be really helpful. So kind of like really looking at nuancing and trying to kind of get a sense of, is this patient in early stages of insulin resistance and blood sugar dysregulation all the way through to type 2 diabetes? And then the blood work isn't great for adrenals, because we're not measuring adrenal hormones. Probably the only adrenal hormone other than sex hormones that we measure is DHEA. And I guess we can measure cortisol as well, but it's not quite as effective as the salivary cortisol rhythms. But we can look at shifts and changes in the sodium-potassium ratio and things like that, which tell us whether or not someone is in more of a stress type of pattern or in more of a sort of insufficiency pattern. And just really looking at adrenal dysfunction. So you can either treat presumptively if you see the patterns, or you might go, listen, we need to do further diagnostic assessment work. And I really love the, you know, just a simple 4-point cortisol and DHEA salivary test across the day could be really, really helpful. So that's kind of what I would think about for fatigue. Definitely looking at diet, looking at exercise, looking at how much sleep they're getting, looking at how much computer time that they've got. Are they exposing themselves to computer screens late at night? Is there a light on in there? I mean, these are all just, you know, we have to kind of take a broader view of living situations and things like that. And then, you know, also sex hormones can be very much part of that. Is this woman premenopausal? Then she might not even be aware that that's happening, but, you know, sleep issues can leading into fatigue and that sort of thing.
I've actually found it very helpful to look at the blood markers as also almost like a clue as to whether certain types of, you mentioned before, functional testing are useful, because I think a lot of the times when patients have to embark on this journey, sometimes doing a lot of functional tests can be very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And that's often a comment and feedback from some patients that we've treated. So the difference with, like, the actual blood work and the functional tests, as you mentioned before, is that it can then give us an idea as to whether or not we can further test or do we treat empirically. So I find that very useful as a tool. Mm. So, and even some patients who have had blood tests in the past that they've done that have been normal, and you mentioned before that the trending of the testing can also be an indicator of where they're headed in their health. So I really find that collecting those previous testing and also combining that with recent testing, because your software allows that to be graphed in a way that makes sense to the patient. So we can actually see and pinpoint what are the parameters that are trending in a negative pattern.
Definitely. Yeah, I love historical analysis. And I also have done work with signs and symptoms questionnaires and things like that, which I sort of look at as being sort of history in motion. Because I'm sure you're aware that when you have that initial interview with a patient, you might be visiting with them for an hour or more, and you're collecting just a ton of information about them. It was my experience that for a lot of colleagues that was just sitting in the back of the file and never actually really came out again. So by, you know, giving this patient a questionnaire of, you know, maybe 300 or 400 like symptoms, which is a lot, but, you know, if someone's really sick, they like to tell you about what's going on. And they're the one that's filling it out and telling you whether it's serious or not and that sort of thing. Can be super helpful. And then combining that with, like you said, the historical analysis of blood work. And, you know, you can sit down with them and say, listen, blood work doesn't lie. There's no fabrication happening here. These are real numbers that have real information associated with it. And it's telling us a story. You know, you're trending towards pre-diabetes. You're trending towards fatty liver. You're trending towards renal insufficiency and renal dysfunction. You're trending towards, you know, further and further sex hormone dysfunction, whatever it is, or cardiovascular risk. And you can really sit down and have a meaningful conversation with that. That's what a lot of the times the work, and people ask me, well, what is it that you do? And I say, I try and facilitate better conversations between practitioners and patients. You know, that's really, I mean, we are their coaches on some level, right? We're there to help them. And I was, you know, struck by how when you were as an internist in hospital, where you would release these, discharge these patients to the GP, and in the back of your mind, you're wondering, are these people okay? And that's got to be hard. You know, you get very, very attached to people's stories and your patients.
But I think also the education can go both ways, right? Patients need to know what to ask for of their doctors. So if they're just told that, oh, it looks sort of okay, then they need to ask, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And what I find in my practice is if I start telling patients, you're not diabetic yet, you're not clinically hypothyroid, but you're trending there. And then their first reaction is, so what do I take? Do I need the medication? I'm like, well...
You know, it's really kind of amuses me when I think about this. And I was just talking to a research group this morning about this too. When we look at how a lab presents their reference range, it has absolutely zero bearing on any research studies, there's nothing backing that up. There are no research studies that LabCorp does about their reference ranges or Quest. And so I find it really interesting that we in the functional medicine realm are held to a higher level of scrutiny than allopathic medicine holds to itself. And I think that's really kind of amusing. So for those of you that are listening, when I could get a blood test, I'm on the West Coast. I could go to my local lab here at my local hospital, and I could get a full panel done of maybe 35 or 40 biomarkers. I could get on a plane and I could fly to Boston and I could get the same panel done at a local hospital in Boston the same day. One would be the morning, one would be the evening. So one might say, oh, well, there's changes and shifting is happening. You're flying and all that kind of stuff. But if we take all of that out, the results would probably be quite close to each other in Boston as they would be here in Oregon. The reference ranges would be very different. And I say very different. They're not going to be hugely different. But I could be pre-diabetic in Boston and be actually normal here in Oregon. Same day, same person, not quite the same blood. In fact, I could even take the same blood, draw it here in Oregon, send it to Boston, and get the lab results. Now, you might be asking, why? Why is that the case? Well, when the majority of lab results, the ranges are derived from a mathematical statistical formula. It's a bell curve distribution. It's saying that 2.5% of the population are going to be high and 2.5% of the population are going to be low, which is going to leave 95% of the population as quote-unquote normal. Now, the population in Boston, they might have a slightly different statistical variation because certain groups in Boston might have higher blood sugar values than they do over here in Oregon. So when we look at the blood values for glucose in Boston, it might be slightly different than they are in Oregon. There are some biomarkers, and I don't know exactly which ones, there are some biomarkers that aren't done like that. But I would say the majority of the main biomarkers that we look at, the normal ranges are derived from statistics. Mm. It's not about health. It's not about wellness. It's not about saying that you're healthy. It's about saying you're normal. We're going to pay attention to you when you're below, and we're going to pay attention to you when you're above. Now, I can understand people kind of going, well, where are these optimal ranges coming from? Well, a lot of that initial work came from Harry Eidner and a group of other old-time doctors that had the privilege of being able to run thousands and thousands of blood tests, look at other data that they had available to them and make correlations. So that was the starting point of it. And then we look at, there are groups like Life Extensions. I'm not sure if you know Life Extensions. They're a group out of Florida. They publish really good research on optimal biomarkers and things. So a lot of my biomarker values are derived from some of the research that they're putting out. And we do our own research as well, and especially on some of these newer biomarkers, some of these new ratios that you're talking about. And if you go to our blog, we'll always substantiate the ratios and with as much research as we can find. So long and the short of it is a lot of the stuff came from Harry Eidner's initial work and he and a few other physicians, including the physician that I ended up studying with when I first got out of school. I've done my own studying and reference and research work and my own clinical work as well. And then we also dive into the research. It really is amazing to me how much research there is out there substantiating tighter reference ranges for looking at things like thyroid problems and that type of stuff, because they're not the lab. They're really looking at it from a health outcomes perspective. So that, I know that's rather a long-winded way of answering that question.
No, but that's actually really important.
You know, if you went to your allopathic endocrinologist, they won't treat you? They're like, why not? But you said I'm sick. I'm like, well, you're technically not sick yet. You're getting there. But there are things that you can do now. And it's almost as if they're stuck between these, you know, healthy and very sick. And they don't seem to have these options. And then they feel almost even worse that, okay, Dr. Wong said I'm not healthy, but she says I can't get medication. So I think there's a bit of panicky moment when they realize they're not that healthy, but it seems that they don't know what to do. And that's where I think they need to be guided through the whole process, that it's actually lifestyle and other changes that can help now rather than waiting for medication to be prescribed.
I think it's a great opportunity to ask them, what does medicine mean to you?
Yeah.
I mean, is it in an orange bottle with a childproof lock on the top? Is that medicine? Because food can be medicine. Sleep can be medicine. Herbs can be medicine. A long walk in the woods can be medicine. Forest bathing can be medicine. You know, we know it, right? It's like, so it's a lot of it is about saying, hey, listen, I want to save you from waiting until you are going to be dependent on a pharmaceutical drug. I don't want that for you, because that's, you know, it's going to have its inherent side effects and risks. What we can do is we can actually right now push that off, hopefully to never happen. And we're going to do it with a number of different things. But here's the kicker. You've got to be part of this process. We've become so trained to open up our glass medicine cabinets in our bathrooms and look at these orange bottles as the savior. And it's such a disconnect from, you know, how we really should be viewing our lives in an holistic way. I mean, so that's part of the conversation, I guess. And some people are ready to listen and be part of that process, and some aren't. Some just want somebody to do it for them, and that's sad, but I guess that's part of that process.
I think a lot of that
also
is that even we as health practitioners and the general population are conditioned into a response where, oh, you have this problem, so take this, rather than actually looking at what are the responsibilities or options that each person has to be accountable for their actions to make that lifestyle change. Because habit change is kind of the black box. Like, we talk a lot about this. I mean, I remember in medical school we talked about behavioral change, but that was just the topic in the first year, and after that we don't ever talk about that again. And yet we see a lot of chronic illnesses are driven by lifestyle issues. So we still, but a lot of the things that are interesting or exciting are a pop of a pill, whether it's a medication or a supplement. So even some patients who are interested in the natural method, they think, oh, well, it's actually a herb or a supplement or one thing that they need to do that's going to give them a result. But often it isn't. It's actually a combination of things. So I think the challenge for us in this area is the time that we need to give to patients, but also the time that they also have to commit to doing these changes. But I feel that we have a lot, all the tools here available. And so definitely think that.
Yeah, I agree.
When patients complain to me about the long questionnaires, I actually say, well, if you really want me to understand more about you in a short period of time, this is one of the ways. Just give a baseline as to where your symptoms are right now. So perhaps 3 to 6 months later, we can do a modified version of this and see if those markers are improving. Because I also find that because journey can be for some time, that they sometimes forget what improved.
Yeah, that's why I love that history in motion concept, because they might have incremental change that's moving in the right direction, but they're not actually aware of it. They might say, well, I still got headaches. Well, I said, well, you know, when you came in, you were having headaches 3 times a day. Now you're having headaches once every 2 weeks. Yeah, the headaches haven't gone away, but that's got to be a heck of an improvement. And they go, well, yeah, maybe you're right. So, you know, it's, I think a lot of it is about dealing with expectations. And I think, you know, one of my teachers, Dr. Dick Tom, who's a really phenomenal naturopathic physician when I was being trained, and he always said, you know, you've got to say to the patients, you know, for every year that they've been dealing with a condition, it's going to take 1 to 3 months per year for them to get over it. And it's just not going to be instantaneous. Now, of course, there are situations where it is instantaneous. And that's where we've got to look at where can we get those quick wins, right? So they may come in focusing on something specific, but if we can help them so that they're, you know, not having indigestion 3 times a day, but maybe once every 2 or 3, you know, weeks or whatever. Or we're helping them with their sleep, so they're getting that extra half an hour and feeling more rested. So, it's a difficult process sometimes because it is about dealing with those expectations. And
that's why I think that when we look at a person holistically, the challenge is even greater. Because not only do we have to address some of the discomforts in a short period of time, but we also have to look at in the long term, how do we actually prevent that from reoccurring?
You're right.
When we integrate in our practice, when we integrate both conventional and functional methods, there's always sort of that challenge that's with us. And I think... sometimes patients may not fully understand the process, but I think if we are able to explain this to them, and I find it really interesting because when I explain these markers to patients and they say, well, I didn't have this problem last year, and they question how come and why is it that they started to feel sick, or why did they start to all of a sudden get food intolerances? And often the issue is that the body is able to compensate and suppress the symptoms on its own. So just because you don't have symptoms again, right, doesn't mean that you're well. So if you have blood testing that indicates that trend, then it's something to be aware of and pay attention to.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think there's also this false belief that, oh, it's just age. It's not just age. You can be a very healthy centenarian.
Yes.
And your blood markers would look perfectly good.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think a lot of us blame things on aging. And, you know, there are challenges that come as we age, but doesn't necessarily mean that you can't live a full, healthy, optimal life in well into your 80s and 90s, that's for sure.
So I guess we've been going through the year of 2020 with something called COVID-19.
Oh, yes.
Have you seen any changes in the blood markers, or is there any kind of observation you've made in the past year? Are people more concerned about their immunity? Are they taking more supplements because, you know, it's meant to be good for them? Any kind of observation at all?
You know, I'd say probably one of the biggest observations that I've had, and it's more of an awareness piece. I think people are more aware of comorbidities in a way that's, and, you know, that's become part of the vernacular. People are talking about it. And what it does for me is it takes a very focused disease or illness, COVID-19, and people are starting to recognize that adverse outcomes are associated with something other than the virus itself. Our body actually is in response to this thing, and our response is very much dictated by these comorbidities. So what are those? You know, lung issues, vascular issues, immunity, obviously. And so from my perspective as someone who's working in the realm of dysfunction, I think we have a tremendous opportunity to really educate our patients about lifestyle and diet and exercise and supplementation. I mean, it's very clear that there are certain nutrients that are really helpful for maybe preventing an adverse outcome. I can't say that, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, you'll never get COVID. That's just, we can't do that. But what we can do is to do our very, very best to make sure that the host in which COVID decides to take residence is not going to have an adverse outcome. We can do our very, very best to make sure that that happens. So what does that look like? That looks like really working with patients with their weight, working with the causes of abdominal obesity, working with the causes of obesity. And from that, we can then extend that through to the whole gamut of blood sugar dysregulation. And then an extension of that, obviously, is cardiometabolic issues. So our cardiovascular system is so interrelated with the lungs as well. So from me, from my sort of research perspective, I'm actually seeing like more dots being connected and more interrelationship between discrete dysfunctions in a way. And then on top of that, we've got much more research on vitamin D than I think. I mean, I think there's been always been a ton of research, but it's kind of risen to the top here, because if you're vitamin D deficient, you know, it's statistically shown that you're probably going to have a more difficult time going through COVID. And so, you know, it's such an easy, simple thing to replace. So I'm not sure that's answering your question.
Yeah,
but I would say that the focus should be less on the immune system. It's not saying that the immune system isn't really important, because obviously it is, but it's more about broadening our view and having conversations with our patients and going, hey, listen, COVID-19 is out there. The chances are that at some point you're going to get it. What you potentially have control over is how your body responds to it. And you say, I can't predict. But what I can do is I can do my very best to assess for where you're at right now, so that we can look at the terrain or the systems of your body to make sure that all of them are functioning as optimally as possible. And we've got great things that we can do now before you have COVID that can make sure that you go into that experience, God forbid you have it, better prepared on a systems level to deal with it.
Yeah, I think it really has brought a lot of things to the forefront of medicine and to the general population, because, you know, it was almost accepted to be obese because 1 in 3 people in America are obese. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
So if you draw a curve, that's your normal distribution.
Yeah, we're going and back so to those lab values,
the numbers,
right?
Have shifted over time to accommodate people who are, you know, quote unquote, not healthy, but are not accepted to be healthy. And it's also true that a lot of the studies now, because, you know, people don't know what to treat it with, they're trying everything. So IV vitamin C has been put to the forefront of this, zinc, vitamin D, like you said. And, you know, these are allopathic doctors doing allopathic studies. And I felt it's, despite the disruption and, you know, the losses we've had to go through, it has brought the two sides of healthcare closer together.
I think you're right. I really do. My concern is that an allopathically trained mind is going to be looking at nutrition through an allopathic viewpoint. So, you know, it's like, it's still that kind of slight magic bullet concept. Oh, if we just give you IV vitamin C and give you vitamin D, it's what we kind of call green allopathic medicine. We're not going to give you a drug, but we're going to give you this bottle of supplements. And I think it's a lot better, absolutely. But I'm kind of optimistic looking to the future of this integrative concept. Yeah.
Even if it means allopathic doctors are looking at it allopathically, at least they're looking.
Exactly. You know? That's a very, we'll take that any day, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's really, really true. Absolutely.
These conditions drives the increase in interest also from researchers, from providers of services. Yeah. I think because people are looking for answers and, you know, apart from the whole debate and vaccines and all those things, I think I still think that there is a real
need for the whole entire general population to wake up and say, oh, wow, we need to really start looking at ourselves and what are we doing and how do I sort of get to eat better and what kind of resources do I need? So I think that aspect of, okay, how do I do it now is really kind of missing because people haven't really thought about that. It hasn't been shone a light on, and the how is often the difficulty sometimes because it requires a change in our habits. So if we're practitioners, we can't do everything for the patient. We actually have to coach them into and motivate them into making those changes. And I think that having an objective marker to look at and being able to remeasure it, which I often say to my patients that, okay, we'll do this lifestyle change for 4 to 6 weeks or 3 months, and then we'll remeasure. And they get this, some of them get this fear. It's almost like a test. but most of the time they are very
Right.
They say, oh, okay, that would be great, because then they feel, if I make this change, I can see an improvement. And often there is an improvement in symptoms too, but people still like to have numbers, like to see that trend. So it empowers people to make that change.
Yeah, whatever we can do to empower our patients to make that change, I think that's super, super important.
So, Dr. Weatherby, where would people come to learn more about Optimal DX and your work? Where would you direct both practitioners and also general population patients who are looking to look at their markers more functionally?
Well, I think the first, you know, for practitioners out there who are interested in looking at functional blood chemistry analysis, come to optimaldx.com. We've got a pretty robust blog and a resource section, and we've got guides and things like that. Mm-hmm. I do a training in functional blood if you're interested in kind of doing a deep dive. And then we've got a software program for those of you that are, you know, running blood markers and want to use a report to have like that better conversation with your patient. You know, we've got that available to you. Unfortunately, at present, you know, my business really is directed towards the clinician, and we don't have a lot of resources for the patient. One of the things that we are working on is a patient directory. So, you know, come on over to Optimal DX periodically and see if that's up. We're a very small company. We try our best to provide as much education as we can and help our clients. And we would love to be able to get anyone who uses our software program to be in a directory so that, you know, patients in Hong Kong, they know where to go to, right? So,
that's the purpose. You can do it online anywhere now. So
I love that. Isn't that great? So you can do a consult and show people a Zoom call and show them their blood values and show them the interactive report and things like that. It's pretty cool. It's really good. Yep.
So I think we've covered a lot of grounds today, and thanks so much for your time. We've previously done an episode on We've previously done an episode 16 on Optimal DX, on how to read functional markers. So if people are interested,
and also I know that 16. Dr. Dickon Weatherby has his own podcast as well. And that's called the
It's called Optimal the Podcast. Yeah, it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. It's relatively new, so it probably hasn't been syndicated yet. So you can always search under Dickon Weatherby and you can find it. The goal that I'm really trying to do there is it is aimed towards clinicians. My goal is to take a topic each month, do a sort of a dive into, like I've just recorded one on insulin resistance, we just posted it. And so we do kind of like a background on what that condition is and what are some of the supportive research around it. And then we look at some of the biomarkers that are associated with helping to uncover whether or not this is something that you're dealing with. It is geared towards clinicians, but I try and keep it as simple as possible. When we're talking about physiology and biochemistry, that's a little hard. But, you know, my goal there really is to engage people to have a sort of an internal dialogue about how they're approaching these important things in our lives and working with patients to have better conversations.
Well, thank you so much for your work. We really appreciate
it. Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for all that you're doing. And, if any of your patients are listening to it, you're in great hands. They're very lucky to have you as clinicians with your broad experience and training and your dedication to their healthcare. So,
we're all listening to you.
Thanks for doing that. Yeah, absolutely.
You can find us at anantawellbeing.com and follow us at Ananta Wellbeing on Facebook and Instagram. If you like our podcast, please give us a 5-star review to help other like-minded people find us. This podcast is for information purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this podcast are not medical advice and is not intended to treat or diagnose any medical condition. This podcast and its producers disclaim any responsibility for adverse effects that result from the use of this information. Opinions of guests are their own and are not endorsed by this podcast. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions. We do not make any representation or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Both producers and guests may have direct or indirect interest in the products and services mentioned. If you think you have a medical condition, please consult a licensed physician.